Hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood.
Happy birthday to you.
Oh, you stinker.
I know, huh? Wasn't that good? That's what you call good producing right there, putting that little bug
amazing.
In my ear. Wasn't that good?
Because she's holding up a sign. Jenny's holding up
a sign.
Well,
she threatened me earlier if I didn't get it right, so you know. This is, of course, Make Me Smart. My name is Kai Rizdahl, and it's this thing we do all the time. Well, actually, every Tuesday with you guys.
That's right. And every Tuesday, we are joined, as always, by you, dear listener. Dear Twitter, dear Facebook Live joiner, none of us is as smart as all of us.
We are going to this week do something interesting. We're going to take one question from a listener, answer it two times. We're going to talk with Molly Hemingway. She is a senior editor at The Federalist about anonymous sources and this administration and some of the consequences of that anonymous sourcing.
And then we're going to take a look at the actual language that is used to describe anonymous sources as sort of a guide to how you can recognize whether they are legit or not. That's going to be with Vince Gonzalez. He teaches journalism at the University of Southern California, and he spent many years breaking investigative stories for CBS News. Fun fact, he covered the Michael Jackson trial with the help of our own producer, Jenny Josephson.
Yeah, I was going to do some Michael Jackson riff, but I can't. All right, as I take a sip of my now cold coffee, we got to get our fix. You know the drill.
It's the news fix.
Well, where should we begin?
I mean,
where should we start? Where should we start? There's so much. Actually, you know what's so what's interesting is the news of this day in our ballpark, and in fact, actually the news of the week because the president's out of town, leads straight into this conversation about how this administration is being covered, and here's why. The big news is, of course, economically speaking, the president's budget, which dropped today. Mick Mulvaney, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, went to the podium at the White House briefing room and gave a 40-ish or so minute presentation in which he laid out the president's spending priorities. And it's really interesting because it is very much a Republican, arguably an... Ooh, I hear the dog. Is that the dog?
Yeah, the dog is having a little meltdown.
I love that dog. I love that dog. the budget document that the White House released today is a very Republican document, but it is very on the very Republican side of Republican. That is to say, it's very business oriented. It's very well. The thing Mick Mulvaney said was, "It's going to be a budget of compassion. We're going to have compassion, yes, for the recipients of social programs in this economy, but we are also going to have compassion for the taxpayers, for the people whose money we are taking and giving away." Which gets us to the first listener question of this day, which goes like this.
Zelina Koteva wrote to us, and this is something we've been kicking around this idea in our Monday morning editorial meetings. I don't know if you've been able to join us, but we do them live on Facebook every Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, and we get these topic ideas. And one of the things that's come up over and over is Zelina's question, which is, does a trickle-down approach to economics really work? Because that is kind of at the heart of this budget. It assumes a bunch of economic growth. And it assumes that by cutting corporate tax rates for the wealthy and for businesses, it will help create that economic growth and that that will then trickle down as an economic benefit to people on the lower rungs who are not, incidentally, also going to lose a fair number of services.
Those of you old enough to remember Ronald Reagan and the Reagan budget of 1980, 81, 82, before David Stockman, his director of OMB, sort of went rogue and wrote his book in which he dumped all over this. Ronald Reagan was famous for trickle-down economics based on something called the Laffer Curve, which basically says the more you tax people, the less revenue you're going to get. So let's cut taxes at the top end. And that money that those rich people don't have to pay in taxes, they will invest back into the economy, and that will boost demand at the bottom end because people on the lower end of the spectrum are going to be able to now afford things because the money that rich people spend will go back into the economy. We can argue till the cows come home. There are not enough hands on enough economists to say, yes, it works or no, it doesn't. The thing you need to realize is that it's back. With Donald Trump, it's back.
It's back, yeah. All right. You're immersed in this. I am not because I'm a lowly tech reporter. I mean, I went to howstuffworks.com and started looking into trickle-down theory, and it's fascinating. And so I feel like it's worth doing just a tiny bit of explaining what the theory is. And did you know, by the way, that the name trickle-down was coined in the 20s by humorist Will Rogers?
Did not.
Who said, quote, which is sort of tells you all you need to know about that name and why they started calling it supply-side economics when they brought it back in the 80s, because it has been around since the 1920s. At that time, Will Rogers said, quote, "The money was all appropriated for the top in the hopes it would trickle down to the needy," which, you know, created this sort of negative association. So originally in the 20s, there was this idea of trickle-down, that you would increase production and that that would then create demand. But then Keynes came along, John Maynard Keynes. See, there, that's why we need you. And then said, no, you increase.
Steve Jobs. Sorry, just kidding. Just making the parallel.
That's awesome.
Tech reporter joke. Sorry.
That's why we do this show together, so we can help each other, because neither of us is very smart.
And we're,
on the things that we are not smart about.
Doesn't know, right.
Okay, but so there's that guy, Keynes.
Right.
And he says, no, 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 you should increase demand.
Right.
And promote consumer demand rather than entrepreneurial production. And then people will consume more and create more jobs.
Right.
Right? Is that a fair?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right as far as it goes. But you have to wrap it all up in what else happens in an economy. And let me fast forward from the 1920s and John Maynard Keynes through John Kennedy and this idea that he loved of the rising tide lifts all boats. And you know, Kennedy's a Democrat, right? And let's get to Ronald Reagan and this idea of trickle down, or as it came to be called by the branding experts in the Reagan White House, supply side economics. They believed that if you increased the supply of stuff, that demand would, if you increase production, right, demand for it would follow because the economy would have more available cash in it, and that would then result in economic growth, which, it has to be said, Reagan got economic growth early in his administration, right? I mean, if you remember, inflation was really high. Paul Volcker came in and controlled inflation. And then the economic recession of the 81-82 era ended because the economy was growing. In theory, everybody went because of supply side or trickle down economics. The thing you need to know, though, is that along with supply side economics in the Reagan White House also came an increase in government spending and a huge increase in government debt. So it is not at all clear whether supply side economics actually works in and of itself. And this is something we say on Marketplace all the time, right? The American economy is today, I don't know what it was in 1980, but today it's a $19 trillion beast. And the idea that one lever or the other is going to change things is not entirely accurate.
Well, right.
We get now to Mick Mulvaney and Donald Trump talking about a return to, although nobody's saying it anymore, right? A return to supply side economics, tax cuts for the wealthy, tax cuts for businesses, an explosion in the federal debt based on this budget, right? And cuts in services to the poor and the lower classes in the hopes that, to quote John Kennedy again, although it's not his quote, a rising tide lifts all boats. And we just have to see how this shakes out. And we got 3.5 years to go.
It's also super important to point out here, as Marketplace Weekend host Lizzie O'Leary, I think, has done a really good job of on Twitter saying that a presidential budget is fundamentally just a political document. It is in no way, it is not legislation. It is essentially policy, but only in the purest sort of political sense, because Congress passes the budget.
Yep, absolutely.
So, you know.
Absolutely. And Paul Ryan, Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, is a budget wonk to the nth degree. And he is going to have his own say with this thing. And that is absolutely for sure. That's a really good point.
What I think is interesting is that when you see comments about the budget proposal, they're in the context of morality. You know, there's all the economic theory and then there's the Laffer curve. The Laffer curve, by the way, made a lot of sense to me. It's like as a middle ground, as a third way, like the idea that there's a point at which you tax so much that you disincentivize. That makes sense. I get that. And it's like a picture. I like a picture. But what I do think is interesting is this kind of question of cruelty. I mean, you're literally seeing people say this budget proposal is cruel. And it raises, you know, there's sort of the pure capitalist argument, the pure economic argument. And then there's the question, which I think is this is gets to kind of the what used to be the historical philosophical divide between Democrats and Republicans, which is how much do you take care of people who need help?
And the question is, where does that fall on the normal, not normal scale?
Right. That's right. True. Yeah.
And you know, Paul Ryan's going to, my guess is Ryan tears this up and starts all over again, but whatever.
Well, that seems to have been the case with everything so far. Because again, it's not a P&L, you know, the federal government, the federal budget is not a simple profit and loss document. There's so much more that goes into it. There's that. There's the question that, of, as President Trump himself said, of the amount of heart that has to be built into governing.
Because government is not a business.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. All right.
So that's us on the budget and trickle-down economics and sort of the news-ishness of the day. Believe me when I tell you we could have gone on for longer on the federal budget because there's so very much in there. So very much in there. Let us know what you think about not just the budget, but everything we do, how we do it, whatever. Write to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org or go to our website, marketplace.org/makemesmart. Tweet at us. I'm at Kai Rosdahl. She's at Molly Wood.
And don't forget about the editorial meetings. I just mentioned them, but they are at facebook.com/Molly Wood, 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. You should also follow Kai, facebook.com/Kai Rosdahl, and then you'll get notified when we're about to go live. Next up, The Federalist's Molly Ziegler Hemingway.
I was just trying to figure out what that music was.
It's beautiful.
It is. It's very peaceful. It's very zen in my over-caffeinated state. What we do on this show, other than ramble, is answer your questions. And a while back, we got a really nice one from Justin Bailey.
Make me smart.
Make me smart.
Hey, make me smart.
Hi, this is Justin Bailey from Portland, Oregon. And I'm wondering, how can ordinary people judge the probability that the memos about Trump can actually contain any truth? In general, what words in a news article signal confidence in the information, even if the news is from unverified or anonymous sources? Thank you.
That is, you know, it's a simple question. It only gets to, I don't know, the future of information in America.
Yeah.
The memo I think he's specifically talking about is that anonymous dossier that was filled with this unverified, or some of it they say has been partly verified, information about then candidate Donald Trump, which was released back in January. But we're not going to go into detail about that on this show because it's yucky.
And it's just too hard because
not necessary. But there are so many other what could be termed anonymous memos, or at least anonymous sources, that we felt we could take it in a slightly different direction, a more sanitary direction.
Totally, because it comes with a set of challenges for not only journalists in this administration, but also consumers of news.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we saw an article the other day. Title tells you why it caught our eye. It went like this: tips for reading Washington Post stories about Trump based on anonymous leaks. It was written by Molly Ziegler Hemingway. She's a senior editor at The Federalist, which is an online magazine that covers politics and policy and culture from a mostly conservative and libertarian point of view.
Yeah. And so we brought her in for a conversation that started with this idea of the anonymous sources. But we talked all about, you know, this is going to be a theme. It was a theme last week, and it's going to go forward, because at this point, the only thing we have is information, and we have to figure out what's real and what's not real. And so in talking to her, we started with anonymous sources and we got all the way out into, you know, the future of media and how the media could cover President Trump. So, Molly, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I'll get used to this in like 5 more minutes. I think this is the first time I maybe have ever interviewed another Molly, even.
I mean, and Mollies are great, but there aren't enough of us. We need to take care of this, rectify this situation.
I agree. Or form a club.
Wait, can I ask a clarification question? Are both of y'all's given names Molly?
Mine is.
Wow. That's like karma. Okay, all right. I'm gonna butt out now and let the questioning proceed.
We were meant to hang out. You're from Denver. I'm from Montana. Like, we probably have all the same stories.
God, I'm like the odd person out here.
I know. Sorry. We'll let you talk, though, sometimes.
Later.
So, Molly, tell us about your work. We've been talking on this show a lot about, you know, what we've called the nurtured narrative. We did something last week about media consolidation and the danger of the various bubbles. And I know that this is something you've talked a lot about. We specifically got very interested in your article about reading Washington Post stories, or I think we could safely say any stories about Trump based on anonymous source and sourcing. Can you walk us through what you wrote there?
Yeah, well, there have been so many stories about the Trump administration that don't just rely on anonymous sourcing, but completely rely on anonymous sourcing. And so it's interesting to think through some of the implications of what that means, you know, how much you can trust anonymous sources, what you should be on guard against, how you should check or verify the information that they're giving, or if that's even possible, and how to just be a smart news consumer in that type of environment where anonymous sources are more than sufficient to sort of set the narrative for a given day.
So can you be a smart news consumer? Because I agree. In fact, I even said to Kai specifically, one headline came out, I got a breaking news alert, I clicked through, I saw that it was an anonymous source, and I just kind of went, oh, because it's so noisy.
Sure. Now, in Washington, D.C., it's very difficult to have any significant story dealing with the government that doesn't use anonymous sourcing. There are fairly obvious reasons for that. It's frequently sharing information that is either unethical or illegal to share, but people feel is important. A lot of major news is broken via anonymous sources who feel that they're doing some type of whistleblower action or whatnot. What's really striking about the Trump era is not that anonymous sources are being used, because they're always used, but just how many are being used.
While I grant you that care and details and diligence and reporting are paramount, full stop, completely agree, it has to be said that for 2 years on the campaign trail, the man who's now the president of the United States said basically every reporter in America is a liar.
You know, this is both true and shouldn't actually affect reporters and how they cover him. It's natural that you would be offended. I mean, I do find it funny that Donald Trump said all these horrible things about so many people, and now when he could use people being fair in response to him, whether that's political rivals or the media, they're just not inclined to be fair. And you cannot begrudge them that after all that he said and did. At the same time, I think journalists should understand our calling as a higher calling, and that it doesn't really matter if someone's mean to us. We should still understand that our reputation is based on our ability to tell the truth and to have a sense of calm about how we do that so that people trust us.
So I was having a conversation the other day with, as it happens, a reporter for the New York Times, but that's not really germane. But she had been out in like Pennsylvania someplace reporting. And the folks out there were very much, yeah, you know, I check the news every now and then, but what I really care about is not, you know, who said what about Comey in the White House to the Russians, but what my health insurance premium is going to be in 18 months. And this correspondent said to me, I wonder if we, that is the mainstream media, are doing it all over again like we did in the campaign, paying attention to the, oh my God, did you see this? As opposed to the voters who are seeing and worrying about something completely different. What do you think?
There was this great story. I think it was Byron York at the Washington Examiner, but he took one of these rallies during the campaign where Donald Trump says a bunch of completely insane things. And the big headlines for many of the reporters were about these, you know, things that really got reporters excited. But then he asked the attendees at the rally what they heard, and they all perfectly got the big message, you know, something about immigration, something about the economy, something about renewed strength in our military posture. And it was just amazing to read the difference between what caught reporters' attention and what caught the people's attention. This current moment is a great example of what happens when you don't learn from your mistakes in coverage. Mm-hmm. And it would have been good for reporters to, and really more editors, to figure out how much they had messed up the 2016 election. Think about how that dictates their coverage, bringing in maybe different perspectives of people who understand the importance of the economy to voters' lives as opposed to the latest thing that Donald Trump said. So yes, absolutely, this is... If we didn't know it before, we know that pretty much no lessons were learned from the coverage mistakes of 2016.
Does it feel new to you that news sources are reporting such dramatically different? I mean, it has become a mini meme in and of itself to compare and contrast what Fox might be reporting to what CNN and MSNBC and NBC are reporting. But a friend of mine recently tweeted that she was in the Salt Lake City airport and overheard a conversation in which a woman said to her husband, "Oh, the Kentucky Derby's on today," while she was watching TV in the airport. And her husband said, "That's on CNN. It's fake news." And she said, "Wait, so the Kentucky Derby is not on today?" And he said, "Check Fox."
Wow.
But what happens when people are consuming completely different narratives?
This is, to me, the question of the age. And it is not healthy that we have people that get news from just one source and they shut out, in fact, other ways of looking at things or other news sources. And it's leading to serious harm in terms of our civil discourse. I mean, neighbors are having trouble talking to each other. Families are having trouble talking to each other. This is not becoming of who we are as a people. Mm-hmm. I would love for Americans to hope for a more neutral or, you know, balanced approach to these things, but I don't think there's a huge market for a news outlet that can serve both liberals and conservatives.
What do you think? We talked about this on a recent episode, the things that are not being covered that can potentially have, you know, impacts for generations. If you had to make a short list of things that you would much rather be talking about, what would be on that list?
Well, actually, first off, I would say that there's an obsession with politics that doesn't match the interests of the American people. Yeah. But setting that aside, there is a way of covering Donald Trump that understands he is a very different president from any other president we've ever had. He was not a military leader. He was not a politician. He was a businessman. He comes from completely outside the D.C. political environment, and it shows in everything he says and does. So rather than waking up every day surprised that Donald Trump is behaving like someone who's not a politician or former military leader, I think understanding that he brings this different perspective that has both risks and potential benefits, and, you know, even something like his trip abroad, where he is laying out a foreign policy vision that's very different, not just from his predecessor, but both of his predecessors, and really the foreign policy architecture that we've had for decades, and being able to kind of step back and make it less about this gaffe or that gaffe, but about what, as he calls it, principled realism is and how that might play out. I mean, that's a very interesting story. It doesn't really benefit Democrats or Republicans. It's kind of outside of that, but it would be a good way to cover him without making it, again, just about a crazy tweet or something like that.
Well, but that goes to something we talked about on the podcast a lot in the beginning of his term, and less so the last couple of months. The idea that there are some things that are happening in this administration that are normal, that are well within the guidelines for a conservative Republican administration to do, whether it's social policy or foreign policy or what have you. And then there are some things, and not a few of them, they're way outside the norms. And I wonder if those are the things that are making everybody go, ah!
Or is there a third category of things that are not normal, but still, like you said, worth exploring?
Right. That's actually how I would say it. That being not normal, being abnormal, does not necessarily mean it has to be treated as the worst thing ever. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I would argue that if you kind of keep an open mind about things or just try and play it down the middle, it allows people to make their own decisions and trust media voices when they do say that something is alarming. When everything is alarming, it's very difficult to view anything as alarming. And when you have a story based, you know, since we were talking about the anonymous sources, when you have a story based on anonymous sources that turns out to not be true, it makes all stories about based on anonymous sources questionable in a way that makes it easy to dismiss. And that's not good because, in fact, there are tremendous risks to having someone so outside of the political system in this office. And we need a media who can hold this person accountable, not just because of what's potential, but even what's already happened in terms of lack of transparency on finances and these types of things. So that voice is very important, and you don't want to throw it away.
Molly, M-O-L-L-I-E, Hemingway, as opposed to Mollywood, M-O-L-L-Y. You know, it's so interesting listening back to that interview and the pushback you wish you had given but didn't. Oh, well.
I know, not to do that in absentia when she's not here. But yes, I had many of the same thoughts. Although I do find myself, you know, in defense of my fellow sort of Western cowgirl, I find myself, I'm not a hysteria-prone person. And so I do occasionally find myself irritated by the news.
And well, and yep.
You know, and I don't think that I'm the only one. And so I can get behind the sort of semi-libertarian assertion that there are some things that you have to just be like, for God's sake, take a step back on, you know?
Right. No, I agree. And her point about so the thing I wish I'd push back on is where she said, you know, you just got to place some things down the middle. And that's not really true, right? Because he said, she said, or on the other hand, you know, that a lot of this that doesn't apply with a lot of the insanity that's going on with this administration. But her point about if everything is a crisis, then nothing's a crisis. Absolutely. Because you can't be at 111,000 RPM every second. You just can't.
Yep, I agree. I would like the Vulcan version, the Spock version of the news some point.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Fair enough.
But not always.
Not always. So where do we go from here? So we go now to practical tips on how to deal with some of the anonymous sourcing that we are finding in the media today. But as always, got to pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
So this is like the day of Mellow Bridges. Okay. All right. I'm down with that.
We're going, we got a classical vibe. It's sort of a deep breath thing.
Holy cow. It'll be interesting to see what everybody who's listening thinks about this music. When it comes to the use of anonymous sources, especially one to work inside the federal government, which is what really is the topic at hand these days, there is a particular type of language to describe those people who don't want to be described.
Yeah, because let's be honest, all of the DC universe, for those people who are obsessed with the news like we are, this DC coverage thing, it's all part of a big game that goes back a long time. Political journalists in Washington, DC have a language, they have a style, they have a set of they have a playbook. Part of the reason that you're seeing such outrage is that the Trump administration in many ways is not playing by the rules that the DC press is used to. And so there are kind of tip-offs for how you can figure out where an anonymous source came to, what a reporter's trying to tell you about that source. But you need, let's call it a decoder ring to help you kind of crack that code.
But you must have it on record somewhere.
Go on, and then? Could there be some other reason, something connected with something official?
You mean any radio or TV station could set them off? Well, that leaves us an alternative, doesn't it?
How on earth do you know that?
Ooh, I missed that last one. What did you say? All right.
I don't know, but decoder ring.
Decoder ring, that's right. We need to crack the code is the short answer. So we brought in Vince Gonzalez. He's a longtime television guy, reporter for CBS, CNN, and PBS. He's also a professor at the University of Southern California, where he runs the graduate program in journalism at the Annenberg School of Journalism.
Yeah, this is a dude who knows his way around a journalistic investigation, the kind that do occasionally require this careful use of anonymous sources.
Vince, thanks for coming on the pod.
My pleasure to be here.
There have always been people who don't want to put their names to things in the newspaper.
That is for sure. You go back and look at archives of ancient newspapers from the 1800s, and you'll find that city officials were quoted because they knew that speaking out would get them in trouble.
To that end, and not to get all McCarthy on you here, Joseph McCarthy, but I hold here in my hands a Washington Post article from May the 15th. Greg Miller and Greg Jaffe have the bylines. There are 16, I counted them, references to or quotes attributed to current and or former U.S. officials. I guess the question is, when you see current or former U.S. official, what do you read into that?
You know, you have to read it all once and then go back and look at those specific spots in the copy you've handed me. It's highlighted every time.
Yeah.
You want to go back as a
consumer. That's because we got good producers. They go, man, go.
Well, you want to go back and you want to read those points because a former government official means a lot of things. It can be someone from the previous administration who wants to get out there and criticize the current administration. It can be someone who is hoping to get back in now that Republicans are back in the White House.
Huh. Okay, so what about denials? Like, sometimes the denials themselves are anonymously sourced to the administration, right?
My favorite one is one that came out about a week after the article we're talking about. The Washington Post headline was, Trump asks intelligence chiefs to push back against FBI collusion probe after Comey revealed its existence. And in the article is a condemnation of anonymous sources by a White House spokesperson.
Yeah.
So the spokesperson couldn't even go on the record to deny these anonymous sources.
So do you just throw your hands up and go, are you kidding me, man?
Yeah, it's like Escher-esque.
You know, if someone turned this into me as a journalism professor or when I was working, I would say, go back and get somebody on the record. This administration is different in some ways in that it's very hard to get some of these things on the record. And so there are other articles that concern me more. One of the other articles we discussed was this New York Times article that came out back in February that goes through kind of the chaos in the White House.
This is the one from that had him upstairs in his bathroom late at night on Twitter watching the TV.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And you know, and talks about the staff not knowing how to turn on the lights and visitors not knowing where to go. It's seven paragraphs of detail about life inside the White House with no attribution whatsoever. And then there's a paragraph that says we interviewed dozens of officials. I don't know what to break down in that. I don't know how to tell what that top of the story, what is real.
And that's becoming increasingly common, right? The Washington Post does the same thing. They give you the, oh my goodness, look at this stuff. And then about six paragraphs in, they say, this account is based on interviews with 32 former, senior, current, whatever things. So they're just doing all the attribution in a block to get it out of the way.
Right. And that block attribution, maybe I'm old school, does not work for me. I mean, that's narrative journalism that's trying to write something that might go in a book. Day-to-day journalism that's meant to inform people, I want to know who says he goes up and sits in his bathrobe and watches cable news and tweets? Who says the White House staff can't find the light switches? To throw it off on dozens of government officials, congressional aides, who, by the way, are not in the White House, and former staff members, could be, I guess, Obama staff members, or again, people with an axe to grind, people who left early during that chaotic transition. Yeah. Those are perspectives, that's context we need to know to really decide the worth of these stories.
Well, in the narrative part, when it gets so look, I understand that as a writing device,
that's great.
It's fun to tell a specific story. But I have that same response where I go, were you there? How do you come by this? And then I feel like the result is a sort of a pile-on to the point where I, even as a journalist, will read these stories, see that they're attributed to anonymous sourcing, and just go like, oh, like what happens to reader trust? At some point.
I think we lose it. Oh, I think we lose it, definitely. I think that we have to be so judicious about using anonymous sources. I mean, and again, I am a firm believer in there are times when they are warranted. Whenever I worked as a reporter, I had to explain those decisions to a producer. We then had to send them to New York and explain to sometimes all the way up to the vice president of the news division why we were using anonymous sources because it calls the whole piece into question if the sources are not credible. And so I think most readers walk away going, well, if someone didn't have the guts to come out, do I trust them? That's dangerous too because there's obviously valuable information in these articles, but when it's not sourced in a way that, again, at least tells me who believes that Donald Trump sits up there and tweets while watching Fox News, I have a hard time knowing the credibility of that statement.
Well, and then to that denials piece too, let's quickly try to decode denials, because I think what will happen is some anonymous sources will say something. The White House will come out and say, you know, for example, General McMaster's, the story as reported is false. And then because we're so polarized, right, opponents of President Trump will say he leaked information to the Russians, and proponents will say McMaster said that was false.
Right.
But there's nuance all throughout there too, right?
For sure. And that, again, is the danger. You lose that nuance. These are not simple black and white stories. And by taking away the context that the person provides who makes the statement, when you know their identity, it strips the story of something. And I think that's why the Washington Post jumped through a lot of hoops to try and give some context, to try and let you know they were talking to people who should actually be able to make these statements. And again, a whole article of anonymous sources, to my mind, is not what you want to do. But if you have to do it, you've got to give us that context.
So there is elsewhere in this episode a conversation with a woman who, Molly Hemingway, and she says, basically, don't use anonymous sources. And I guess my response is, but this is, you know, not the upstairs in the bathroom tweeting in the middle of the night, right? Or a bathrobe, rather. Although we might be in the bathroom, we don't know. That's nice little gossip and goes to state of mind, but it's a little bit prurient, right? But the idea of him discussing classified information with the Russians in the Oval Office is a matter of vital national import, which has to get out there. And if anonymous sources are the only way, then that's the way.
With anonymous sources, the best rule to follow is don't do it until you absolutely have to. You always, as a reporter, want to push to get people on the record at every level, for local reporters, for national reporters, to get the documents, at least, that back up what an anonymous source says. But in situations like that, exactly, when you're describing something of vital national security importance, the future of our democracy, you're going to see people using anonymous sources. The danger is, as we've discussed, is you use them over and over and over and over again, and people start to wonder if the reporter's just making up these sources. I mean, there's no way to confirm it.
So here's another thing, another instance And it goes to that whole senior administration official thing. So the budget, we are recording this on Tuesday. The podcast episode drops on Tuesday. Last night, Budget Director Mick Mulvaney went to the briefing room at the White House and said, here's what's coming in the president's budget, which I'm officially going to release tomorrow. And it was either off the record or not attributable to him, but to a senior administration official. This morning, he went to the podium and gave, in essence, and he said this at a couple of points today, the exact same briefing.
Right.
Why does the Washington Press Corps tolerate that behavior?
Well, I think there's just a game that is played. There are rules that have been in place, and maybe because of this new administration, things will change, but there's just been a way they've done it. But that has been a practice that has probably not served us very well and may not serve us well when you're dealing with this kind of administration.
And which gets us to today, where it's all anonymous sources, right?
Right.
I mean, there's a link between the senior administration official on background briefing reporters and anonymous sources in a paper.
Exactly.
All right.
It's a problem in that, again, I'm not saying for these reporters who we're talking about, but I see it. It can lead to lazy reporting. It can lead to reporters being used to float trial balloons, to float false information. The good thing about these stories is, and one thing that makes me really happy about them, is that they are the work of strong, traditional beat reporters. These are people who have worked a beat, worked sources. When I read these names and I read these articles, I am trusting in that I know they know the people in power. They know the staff. They know the people who are actually working on the policy, who are trying to find the light switch in the White House. So with them, I have a level of trust. The problem is you see it proliferating across all kinds of media, all kinds of articles, entertainment stories now, the quote anonymous sources and things like that. It's everywhere. And that's the danger. And that's part of the trust issue we have in the media.
Vince, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You can follow Vince, should you be interested, on Twitter. He's at VGonzalezUSC. That's V, the letter V, GonzalezUSC.
And I'm going to be trying to find out if I can take a class from him. That one almost made me tear up a little. I mean, granted, it's Tuesday and the news is really bad on the day that we're recording, but that feels like a morning. Okay, anyway.
We've got a book club related correction. Scott Weinman is credited, has been credited in our discussions, as the person who suggested Jonathan Haidt's The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion for our book club. He suggested it in early May, but however, comma.
Turns out listener Peter Harkins also recommended the same book back in March. And I should also say here that my friend Eric recommended this book.
Wow. Everybody
loves me. In like February, and he was like, hey, where's the credit? Anyway, we offered to send Peter a pop socket as well. He joked, though, in response that he has absolutely no idea what a pop socket is, but he is a really big fan of butterscotch.
So honestly, before I started doing this little enterprise that we got going here, I had no idea what a pop socket was either. So, Peter, I feel you, man. You know,
I didn't know until about 2 weeks before we got ours when my child, in case you guys missed this anecdote, my child alerted me to them because apparently all the YouTubers do it. But thank you for the suggestion, Peter. As soon as we get some branded butterscotch, we'll totally send that. For those of you who have written to us and asked how you can get a Make Me Smart pop socket, which is, in case you literally just arrived at our podcast and don't know what we're talking about, it's these little round discs that you stick on the back of your phone, and it makes it easier to hold the phone and to prop up the phone like a little tripod. And according to some people, may also rip a hole in your jeans, although I put mine in my back pocket all the time.
Some people whose name is Jenny Josephson, who is the producer of this podcast, and that's what happened to her, I'm just saying. But moving on, it is that time again in public radio, or at least in podcast land, where we are asking for some help to support our efforts to understand how this economy works, how technology works, how it all impacts our lives, and more importantly, to our purposes, what you want to get smarter about. Because Marketplace is an independent, nonprofit news organization. Because Marketplace is an independent, not-for-profit news organization, which means we count on your support.
And you can now, and a lot of people have asked us about this as well, which I find more heartwarming than I can even believe. A lot of you have asked us how you can support Make Me Smart directly. And now you can, thanks to the awesome Jenny Hatfield in our marketing department, who's been working tirelessly on this and who got us the branded pop sockets. We now have at our website, marketplace.org/makemesmart, a donate button. And if you go to the website and you click on donate, you will see an option. There's all kinds of gifts because it's public radio, but you'll see an option for a Make Me Smart Pop Socket bonus gift. And if you don't see it right away because you're on your phone or whatever, just keep scrolling because it's there.
We don't have all that many of them in the house yet, but we're going to get some more. If you want one, make your contribution right away. Donate any amount. Select the Pop Socket gift thing there. Go to marketplace.org/makemesmart, and there is a big donate button on that page. I think it's green. It goes money, and that's where you got to click. All right? All right. And with that, I think, Molly Wood, we are out of here, right?
Okay. Okay.
That's a nice Pop Socket you got.
We're out of here. That's it.
So somebody hit me on Twitter the other day and said they listened to the goodbye music, the out music, at double speed, and it actually sounds fairly rocking.
Oh.
So I just thought I'd throw that out there. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Therese Castle, Sean McHenry, and the senior producer, Nancy Vergali. The program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez. The theme music, which if you play it at double speed, I'm told, is rocking, was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
Can we play it at double speed just to see if Kai will dance?
I'm not dancing.
The executive producer of Marketplace is Atar Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And if anybody knows whether Kai has ever danced, I bet it's
you know, her. Honestly, it was like in college, and that was it. And I was under the influence, shall we just say. Now I'm going to get fired. Bam.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.